the book of Ruth, chapter 3, we're in this evening. We have seen, hopefully you've been following along with us, long story short, Elimelech and Naomi, two Jews from Bethlehem, took their two sons when a famine hit Bethlehem, and they moved to Moab, an idolatrous, immoral country. Spent 10 years there, and in the 10 years, Elimelech died, the two sons got married, and then the two sons died. So basically, there's these three widows all alone. They hear that the famine in Bethlehem is over. It's been 10 years. She tells Orpah and Ruth, her two daughters-in-law, really go on home. There's no way you're going to be able to marry any of my kids. You know, I don't have any kids, and I'm not married, and you're younger and cuter than me anyway, so your odds are better if you go home. Orpah said, yeah, it sounds right to me, and she left. And Ruth said, no, I'm going to go with you. So the two of them went back to Bethlehem, and they were poor widows. Elimelech had sold his land in Bethlehem, wouldn't come back to him, or now he's dead, wouldn't come back to Naomi or her offspring until the year of Jubilee, which could have been up to, you know, 49 years away, or at this point, I guess, 39 years away. So bad situation. The way that welfare was set up then in the law of God was that people worked for what they ate. And the way God set that up was he told the landowners, when you harvest, only harvest once. Don't go all the way to the corner. Don't pick up stuff off the ground that you drop. You know, just leave some stuff for the poor people so the poor people can come and pick the stuff up or harvest what's left. And that way they'll be able to eat and everyone will be fine. So Ruth volunteered to go do that for her and Naomi. She just happened to. We talk about how things just happen to happen, which they don't really just happen to happen. Coincidence not being a kosher word, according to the rabbis. She just happened to glean in this field belonging to Boaz, who it turns out was a near relative or a near kinsman of Naomi, or more specifically Elimelech, the dead husband. Boaz respected her for the commitment that she had made to her mother-in-law, that she didn't have to. He blessed her with kindness. He protected her with security. He provided her with extra portions of food, so much so that when Naomi saw how much of this barley grain that Ruth brought home, she just said, man, whose field did you glean in? This guy likes you. And so this is where we have got to, is Naomi saying, hey, it's good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, lest others fall upon you in another field. So stick in his field, basically. So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Now we pick up in chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? And now is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Now, we learned in our study of chapter 1 about the law regarding widows. Deuteronomy 25:5 tells us that when brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. So the idea was that when Naomi's son died, whom Ruth was married to, the law said that she should have married another son of Naomi, a brother of the guy who died. But she didn't have any more sons. He didn't have any brothers with which that she could be married to. So that was, of course, why she had told both Ruth and Orpah to return to their own parents' houses so they'd be able to marry again. But now Naomi is forming a plan. You see, Boaz, while not a brother of the deceased, certainly a close enough family member to warrant marrying him and continuing on the family name. The family and the inheritance, all these things were tied so closely together that the law very specifically stated that if all possible, to adhere to this law, Levirate marriage, to basically marry the guy's brother or marry the guy's uncle, have a son, and that way that son becomes legally and technically the son of the deceased, therefore keeping the land and everything all straight and in their name. So Naomi is figuring out that Boaz who's obviously taken a liking to Ruth, can fulfill the law and marry Ruth. And so she's saying, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Now she calls him our kinsman. And this is really the fulcrum of the entire story, the fact that he is a kinsman. And it's not just a husband for Ruth that a kinsman can provide. It's not just, children that he could have with Ruth. That's not the only problem he can solve. He, as a kinsman, can also solve Naomi's problem. Naomi's problem is that her husband sold their plot of land in Bethlehem when they moved to Moab. And that's not going to come back to her family till the year of Jubilee or until she can buy it back. Well, being a poor widow without a job, she's not going to be able to buy it back. She needs a kinsman redeemer. She needs a kinsman who can buy the land back for her. Now, what's a kinsman redeemer? It's a very, very involved legal, technical, biblical concept, which I'll try and just summarize for you in one section of Leviticus. But if you don't understand what the kinsman redeemer is, you won't understand what's going on in Ruth, really, for the rest of the book. You also won't understand when we get to Revelation chapter 5 and we read about the seven sealed scroll and someone, says, who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll? Who is worthy? And no one was found worthy. And John wept when he found that no one was found worthy until, wait a second, there's a kinsman, the Lamb who was slain, the Lamb of God. He is worthy to break the seals. He is worthy to open the scroll. And unless you understand this kinsman redeemer thing, Revelation chapter 5 won't make any sense to you anyway. So if you turn to Leviticus chapter 25, and as you're turning there, remember that the land of Israel belonged to God. God, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, but God has set aside a special portion of real estate, and that's the nation of Israel. Not the nation of Israel as defined by borders today, but the nation of Israel as defined by the borders outlined in the Old Testament, which go way from the sea all the way halfway through Iraq to the river Euphrates, and north and south pretty extremely far. It's a good piece of land, and God said, it's all mine. Do you know that Saddam Hussein right now is in possession? Half of his country really belongs to God, and he's thumbing his nose at God saying, mine, 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 all mine. There will come a day when it's not his, all his. The land of Israel belongs to God. And yet, as children of God, as a country governed by God, he gave Israel the right to inherit that land and to keep it in their family. And that was one of the reasons why he had the year of Jubilee, because even if a family got poor and said, man, we got to sell our land, we got to sell our farm and fields to these Moabites or to this other group of folks, at the year of Jubilee, it would all revert back. You, as an Israelite, you couldn't technically sell your land. You were just basically leasing it. You were selling it for a period of time until the year of Jubilee. I mean, if two years before the year of Jubilee comes and you were poor, you could sell it, but 2 years later, it reverted back to you. That was part of the contract. That was part of God's law. And so God's saying, the land of Israel is mine, was mine, it will always be mine. And so the best you can do is get rid of it for 50 years, but that's tops. It comes back to you. But when it says in Leviticus 25, the law says, in Leviticus 25, verse 23, the land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Thus, for every piece of your property, you are to provide for the redemption of the land. In other words, in any sales contract, you needed to have in that contract, look, a redemption clause. That means if I get money, I'm going to come back and buy it from you, and you have to sell it to me. Or if one of my near kinsmen, my close relatives, gets enough money, he can be able to buy it back for me. Or at the year of Jubilee, it's going to revert back to me anyway. So you have to provide for the redemption for the land, God says. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold. or in case a man has no kinsman but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it and so return to his property. In other words, he's got a piece of land. The year Jubilee's 49 years away, and he says, I'll sell you my property for $49,000. Well, 9 years later, he's got, don't you hate it when I do math off the top of my head? 9 years later, he goes, I have the money to buy this back, and so here's $40,000. Basically, you know, you gave me $9,000 for the 9 years you had, you know, but, you know, so it was all kind of prorated. It was God's prorating sort of system. So he shall calculate the year since its sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert that he may return to his property. So this was the provision. The year of Jubilee, buy it back yourself, or a kinsman could come and redeem it. His nearest kinsman, as a matter of fact. And if you had to sell your land, as Elimelech did when he moved his family away from famine-stricken Bethlehem and into Moab, your closest relative could buy it back for you. Well, Naomi has had, you know, a plan. She just got a plan. Boaz likes you, Ruth. Boaz, near as I can tell, is the closest relative of my late husband Elimelech. He could marry you, carry on the family name. He could redeem the land for me. The land stays in the family. This could be a good plan. This could be the way. And so, knowing that he's going to be winnowing barley at the threshing floor, Naomi begins to tell Ruth how to prepare. Verse 3, wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do. And she said to her, all that you say, I will do. So Naomi instructing Ruth what to do. First thing she says is, you know, get dressed. You've been gleaning barley all day. you smell kind of like the field. You know, take a bath here. Anoint yourself. Put on some good clothes and go. And our kinsman Boaz, he's going to be down at the threshing floor all night. Well, that's obviously not where he lived. What's the deal with that? Remember, this was the hard time of the barley season when it was harvested. The whole crux of this story has been Ruth gleaning in the fields. They have been harvesting these fields, and they have bunches of this barley that's now harvested. But if you know anything about farming, of which I know very little, just enough to be able to explain it to you, those who can't do teach, you hear that, right? The grain is the only useful part of the barley. The rest of it just gets burned up. You know, you wouldn't really want to make barley bread out of the whole thing. It would be pretty gross. But so what they would do is they would winnow this, or they would thresh this. And the way they did that is they stamped it out and basically beat this stuff out and to loosen the grain from the stalk, from the, I forget what they call that, the chaff. Right, they would beat that thing up, and then they would take big winnowing forks and throw it in the air. And on a nice windy day like today, ideally, what's supposed to happen is the chaff, which is much lighter than the grain, blows away, and the grain, which is heavier, well, on a day like today, the grain would also blow, but not as far. But ideally, the chaff blows away, and the grain falls back to the threshing floor. And so that's what they would have, these threshing floors up on these hilltops, you know, hopefully the highest place, which is kind of interesting, because back in Judges, remember that Gideon was trying to thresh wheat in the wine press. The wine press was always in the valley, because who wants to carry a load of grapes uphill? You know, they're mostly water. So the threshing floor to catch the wind is up high. The grape, somebody help me out, where you stamp all the grapes. Wine press. I think I just said that. The wine press was down low in the valley, and there was Gideon, the mighty man of valor, as the angel of the Lord said, you know, the Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor. Well, there he is trying to thresh wheat in the wine press. You know, not a lot of wind down there. And so anyway, these guys would do this, and they would. This was harvest time. This was the time of year where all this, you know, their year's work now is in summation. I mean, they've harvested all this stuff. Now it's time to winnow it, get the grain, and this is their year's income. I mean, this is where they've gotten the income for the year. So this is a glorious time. It's a happy time. It's a spiritual time. It's a financially blessed time. It's the time of year that. Well, the Lord had said about it in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 13. He said, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you have gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat. And you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your towns." You get the idea that everybody's having a party at this point. 7 days you shall celebrate a feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you shall be altogether joyful. So this was a pretty good, solid 2 or 3 weeks of happiness here, because, yeah, they've done all this hard work, but now as they're winnowing, they would have parties at night. You know, it's just like, this is awesome. And then they would sleep by the piles of grain, because, you know, if you went home, then obviously the guy who hasn't done any work, man, he brings his donkeys up there with a couple of barrels on each side, fills them up, rides away, you're ripped off, and he's gotten away with it. So the workers and the field owners, everybody, would actually sleep around the grain like watchdogs, you know, keep protecting their year's investment is what this is. And so it's a time of financial riches, is a time of parties and happiness. And, you know, a week after this, the Feast of Booths is going to happen. They're going to be sleeping out under the stars. They're going to have a week-long party. It's just like 2-3 solid weeks of fun, basically. And, you know, they're working, but, you know, work can be fun. Tell your teenagers. So Naomi is instructing Ruth to do this, to wash up, put on some nice clothes, anoint herself. And she is to wait until the party's over, and then, knowing that Boaz would be sleeping near the grain, find where he's lying down. And she tells him, interestingly enough, "You shall go and uncover his feet and lie down." Now, to me, I don't know if you guys know how I feel about feet, but, I mean, that would be the end of that plan. this is what she says, and we'll see why. But "You shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what you shall do." And so she says, "Okay, I'll do everything you said." Verse 6, "So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, 'Who are you?' And she said, 'I am Ruth, your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative.'" Now, we shouldn't interpret this as anything immoral. I mean, I can imagine at first Boaz, you know, maybe his heart was merry, he'd eaten and drunk, you know, and I can imagine that when he woke up in the middle of the night, you know, it's like, oh, somebody kicked the covers off my feet or whatever, and he wakes up and there's a woman there. You know, that might not be a good situation, but there's nothing immoral going on here. And what's happening, Ruth is not coming on to Boaz or the uncovering of and laying at his feet. In reality, she was making herself a servant. She was humbling herself. She was not prostituting herself. She was not being immoral in any way, shape, or form. She was saying, "I am your humble maidservant here." Remember that feet, you know, feet. The feet was, to wash the feet was the place of the lowest servant. Remember, John the Baptist said, "I'm not even unworthy," talking about Jesus, "I'm not even unworthy to untie the guy's shoes," you know. So and when people would come in and you had visitors or whatever, the most humble thing you could do to serve them is, "Hey, come in, sit down, let me wash your feet." You know, that was what they did. So she's uncovering his feet and laying at his feet and saying, I'm your maid here, I'm your servant. And she says, I'm your maid, so spread your covering over your maid, for you are close relative. Now, that she's not saying, you know, hey, give me some blanket here. That's not what is being said. It's actually this. The translators, I didn't look at what the NIV said. Does it say covering or? Okay. Garment. Okay. It's neither covering nor garment nor blanket. What this literally is she's saying, spread your wings over your maid. And I think the translators of all our Bibles are trying to make it more understandable to us, but I think what they've done is clouded the issue. Remember that, I think it was in chapter 2, Boaz, when he was complimenting Ruth, he said, may the Lord, this is in Ruth 2:12, may the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Same exact word. Here translated wings, you know, and where we are in chapter 3 translated covering. But it's the same phrase. He said, Ruth, I really admire you and I hope you're blessed because you've taken refuge under the wings of the Lord. And now she's come to him and she says, I want to take refuge under your wings. I want you to spread your wings over me. And so poetically there's writing sense, you know, a literal sense, there's a contrast here. The book of Ruth is full of these. I haven't bored you with a lot of them, but I think we've missed this one because of the translations. So she's not being forward when she says, spread your wings over me. She's saying, I want to take refuge under your name. I want to take refuge under your protection. I want to take refuge under you as a kinsman redeemer. She's saying, because the reason, you know, so spread your wings over your maid, for you are a close relative. And she's saying, you are my Ga'al, my kinsman redeemer. That's it. That is the Hebrew name, the Ga'al. Sometimes you'll hear people pronounce it the Goel. The Ga'al, the kinsman redeemer. This was the guy who was the close relative, the kinsman redeemer. So she's saying, so spread your wings over your maid, for you are a Ga'al, or you are my close relative. Now, interestingly enough, back in Deuteronomy 25, and we'll actually turn there again before the evening's over. In Deuteronomy 25, when we're talking about the law of levirate marriage, it sounds like the woman is the one who's supposed to instigate it. Remember when Jesus was presented with a hypothetical problem from the Sadducees who didn't believe in the resurrection. They came up and said, oh, so there's a resurrection, huh? Well, here's what happened. Let's say a guy and a girl get married. The guy had 7 brothers. A guy and a girl get married. He dies. And so she married his brother. And then he died. And so she married another one of the brothers. And then he died. And so on and so forth until all 7 brothers had died. You know, if I was like the 4th brother, I'd be like, you know what? No. It seems that from the reading the law in Deuteronomy 25, that she had her pick, like it was up to her to go and instigate that, that it was up to her to go and say, to walk up to him or do as Ruth is doing and instigate it and say, you are my Ga'al, you are my kinsman redeemer, you are the one who is going to marry me and carry my late husband's name on down by bearing me children or, you know, having children with me. So it seems like she's doing that. And so she's not doing anything improper. I mean, I just can't stand it when you know, you read some of these liberal Bible commentaries and when you come across them, they're so carnal. They're so anti-God almost. They're not even worth keeping in your library. You know, some people think a big library looks cool. Well, I throw out books that have no value. And so a lot of these, you'll see guys going, well, this certainly was questionable and this and that, you know. But it wasn't questionable. It wasn't immoral. She was obeying the law of the levirate marriage. She was being a servant to Boaz. She was honoring what her mother-in-law Naomi had told her. Really not an issue morality-wise. Now, verse 10, then he said, may you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first, by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." Boaz was a lot older than Ruth. I mean, like father age, uncle age. Something that comes across in the Hebrew that doesn't in the English is in the script of this book, in the Hebrew writing, the dialect is even different between the two generations. When Naomi and Boaz speak, actually, believe it or not, they never meet in the book, and we'll talk about that next week. But when they speak, they are using more of an older people, eloquent, more of a proper language. Well, when Ruth, the younger people in the book speak, it's a different thing. It's almost like if you scripted it out, you know, and you had parents speaking proper English, and then the kids going, "Yeah, dude, whatever." You know, you can actually see that in the Hebrew that it's coming through. So Boaz, even in the language, you can tell he's older. And whether he was a brother or a cousin to Elimelech never tells. He's near as we could tell, he was the closest relative, or as near as Naomi knew, he was the closest relative. So he was a lot older than him, and so, or a lot older than her. And he says, you know, "Be blessed to the Lord, my daughter. You know, you could have gone after the younger, cuter guys. You know, some of them are richer than me, some of them are poorer than me, but you didn't go after them." And he says, "I will do whatever you ask because you are a woman of excellence." The King James renders this word virtuous. In relation to women or wives, this word is combined three times in the Old Testament, excellence or virtuous. Here, also, we're familiar with what's known as the Proverbs 31 woman, which we can actually go ahead and flip to Proverbs 31. We won't comment a lot on it, but just if you're not familiar with the virtuous woman. Solomon writes in Proverbs 31, verse 10 of her, "An excellent or a virtuous wife, who can find? For her worth is far above jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. She senses that her gain is good. Her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is gain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands, and let her works praise her in the gates." Now, I often think of this description that we call the virtuous woman is the woman's version of the list of requirements for elders and deacons in 1 Timothy and Titus. You know, as a guy, you read this list and you're like, right, like I can never measure up. And I feel like women must, when they read this, go, oh, yeah, right. You know, this is like super mom. This is like the soccer mom that's also a business executive and has time to run her own business, too, you know. But Boaz is using the same description that Solomon says, a virtuous woman, an excellent woman. He's saying, Ruth, all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. Everybody in town, based on what she had done for her mother-in-law, based on her work ethic, based on her interaction with the people in Bethlehem since they came back from Moab, they're all saying, man, that's a virtuous woman. That's the, Proverbs 31 hadn't been written yet, but that's the Proverbs 31 woman. That's who Ruth was. Now, the third place, Proverbs 12 also says, A virtuous or an excellent wife is the crown of her husband, but she who shames him is as rottenness in his bones. So that's the third place there. So there's those three places that the virtuous woman or the excellent woman is spoken of. The word virtuous or excellent is used a lot more in the Old Testament, but that relating to women or wives. Proverbs 12:4, Proverbs 31, and here in Ruth chapter 3. So he's saying, I'll do whatever you ask. You know, you're a virtuous woman. Everybody knows it. And now, verse 12, it is true that I am a close relative. This is the place where, you know, the women's clasp their hands and sigh, and this is the love story. It's the climax of the, oh, this is wonderful. Then the organ music comes in. You know, this is where the plot gets difficult. However, there's a relative closer than I. Oh, no. It's true that I'm a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. This is where the plot kind of takes a twist and gets difficult. He says, remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. See, they had to stick to the law. If there was a closer kinsman, the closer kinsman got first crack at it, you know, got first opportunity to do this. It was really his responsibility. He could choose not to do it, but it wasn't good. I mean, it wasn't a good situation if he did, as his reputation kind of got ruined and stuff. So this is the really the sticky part of the story, that there's a kinsman closer than Boaz, and legally he would be the first in line to redeem Naomi's land and marry Ruth. Verse 14, so she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. They are in an interesting predicament where, in a sense, they just spent the night together. You know, nothing happened. Nothing immoral about it. But if people saw Ruth leaving the place where Boaz had been sleeping, obviously been there the night, that's a bad thing. And that's where we begin to need to consider about living above reproach. Believe it or not, it's not just okay to live right before God. We also need to live right before man. Not as people pleasers. You know, we don't have to bend over backwards to make sure that we're constantly pleasing everybody. We'll never do it. You know, if you've got two people that you're trying to please, if they feel differently about something, you're trying to be a people pleaser, you're going to offend one of them. Or you could be like me, not try and please either one of them and offend both of them. But there is a thing in Scripture, as well as in our own hearts, that we need to walk above reproach. We need to walk circumspectly, as the Bible says. We need to keep in mind that, you know, right now Ruth has the reputation as being a virtuous woman. Hey, one rumor gets started that she spent the night at Boaz's threshing floor. She's not going to be known as a virtuous woman. I mean, she will be known, but it won't be as of a virtuous woman. This applies to us in the respect that just as there are gossips waiting to find you when you trip up, to find you in a compromising situation, it's not enough to live in such a way that, okay, I can do things like this. I mean, it's right before God. There's nothing immoral about it. But I could get away with this because nobody saw me do it. And that's where we're wrong. Because we forget that we live life not only on a physical plane, but on a spiritual plane. Not only what we do is seen by others or not seen by others, but what we do is seen by God, seen by the angels in heaven, and seen by the enemy's demons. Because they're just cruising around, waiting to get us in trouble. The epistle, first epistle of Peter 5:8 says, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your enemy, or your adversary, the devil, prowls about like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. You have an enemy that's looking for opportunities to accuse you. And you can live right before God You can be like Job and live righteously before God. Job didn't just sacrifice for himself. Job sacrificed for his kids too, in case maybe they got drunk and cursed God in their hearts or something. Job was a righteous man. But Satan still found opportunity to accuse him. So don't be under the impression that, oh, as long as I'm right before God, I mean, I could spend the night at Boaz's threshing floor and nothing happened. I know nothing happened. God knows that nothing happened. That's all that matters. No, that's not all that matters. Because if you're not living above reproach, then if you're living in a way that people can accuse you, and believe me, if it's at all possible, people will. People will. We need to live right before man and before God. We need to ask ourselves all the time, what am I doing? If this were made public, would I be ashamed? If the police knew what I was doing, would I be arrested? That's always a good one. If an unbeliever saw this, would it be a bad witness? If my coworkers knew this, would it bring reproach on my reputation? What we say, what we do, how we live, how we drive, how we talk to people, how we handle our finances, how we spend our time, how we pay our taxes, when we pay our bills, how we dress, how we appear to others. These things might be technically right before God, but are they above reproach? Are they above accusation? Ephesians 5:15, I like the way the King James says it. See then that ye walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise, redeeming the time because the days are evil. Why do you need to walk circumspectly? Because you're evil? No, because the days are evil. The days are evil. People are waiting to accuse you. You are living in a glass house because you have said, I am a Christian. And I like circumspectly because it makes me think of looking 360 degrees all the way around me. That's the way I need to walk, circumspectly. 1 Thessalonians 5:22 says, abstain from all appearance of evil. Abstain from all appearance of evil. Not just avoid evil. That's a given, hopefully, as a Christian. But even the appearance of evil. Is it something that even though you weren't guilty of sin, that could bring reproach on you or bring reproach on Christ or on your reputation because it appeared that way? If you walk in this way, you won't give the enemy an opportunity to accuse you. Boaz, not wanting to give the devil or the local gossips any opportunity, says, hey, well, before the sun comes up, scoot on out of here. You know, before one could recognize another. In other words, you know, it was just barely enough light. People didn't know who that was leaving. And verse 15, before she leaves, though, he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her, and she went into the city. And when he came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did it go, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her. And she said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then she said, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest until he has settled it today. Naomi somehow gets this peace that he's going to redeem my land. He's going to marry you. As long as this works out, these 6 measures of barley somehow communicated the message to her that he's not going to rest, that they're both included, and he's not going to rest until the matter's done. How in the world did she get that? I mean, what kind of secret code is 6 measures of barley and saying, hey, don't go to your mother-in-law empty-handed? He mentioned the mother-in-law giving 6 measures of barley. How did Naomi know that everything was okay? It's this weird secret code, which is really clear to the Jews. I don't think it was clear to Ruth. Remember, she had only been an Israelite. I mean, she grew up in Moab. She had only been an Israelite for a short time. She'd only been in Israel for a short time. I bet this whole thing went right over her head. I think she was going, hey, thanks for the meal, you know, or thanks for the barley. But Naomi said, 6 measures? Remember that back in Genesis, I think it was could have been, yeah, chapter 19, that Lot was, no, it wasn't 19, it was 18. It was before this, and it was Abraham. What am I talking about? Chapter 19 is Lot, chapter 18 is Abraham. Abraham, three guys come up. It turns out to be the Lord and two angels. They're going to go check out Sodom and Gomorrah, make sure it's as wicked as everything everyone says it is, and then blow it up. But on the way, they walk by Abraham's house, and he says, "Oh, come in, let me wash your feet. Let's have some fellowship, you know, stay for a barbecue kind of thing." And Abraham hurries into his tent and says, "Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes." From Genesis 18 on, three measures of flour, three measures of meal, three measures becomes what's known as the fellowship offering. That's pretty important to understand, too, by the way, when Jesus said the kingdom of God is like a woman who took leaven and hid it in three measures of meal. I'm going to try and not sidetrack us here, but that's the fellowship offering. Well, what Boaz did was he poured out six measures of meal. Now, you math scientists out there, what does that mean when you pour out the fellowship offering twice? That probably means, Naomi, I'm going to marry Ruth, and I'm going to redeem your land too. You're both included in my fellowship. That's the way I see it, and I believe that's the way Naomi saw it. Now, another thing that wouldn't have even been obvious to me is the fact that out of the fact that he gave six measures of barley, that she knew he wouldn't rest until the matter was done. Why is that? Well, again, I think it had to do with the fact that he measured out six. Because remember, again in Genesis, the Lord created the earth in 6 days. He didn't rest until the seventh day. He finished everything he had to do on the sixth day. He didn't rest until it was done. And I think that was probably way more obvious back in the days of the judges than it is today. But I think that Naomi said six. That's significant. I don't believe he's going to rest until the matter's finished, and I think he's going to—he won't rest until it's done today. The man will not rest until he has settled it today. So maybe that was more obvious then. Maybe I'm reading more into it, and she's just a positive thinker. I'm not sure, but that's kind of the way I see those things. Chapter 4, Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz spoke was passing by. So he said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside and sat down. Now, remember when we read about the Proverbs 31 woman that, where does it say that? Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. The gate was the place in a walled city where business was done, where courts were held, where judgments were made, where customs were, they went through, you know, they weren't customs. It was the first place that travelers and merchants came to. The city gate was like the place. It was kind of like we would think of downtown in any given city. You know, typically a city, there's a courthouse and everything's built around it, you know. Well, the gate was the main place back in those days, and the elders of the city would sit at the gate. They would render judgments and things. And here's Boaz, and he comes and sits at the gate. Boaz, obviously a very well-known man, a wealthy man, and a man such that he could, when he sees this relative of his, who could have been a brother or a cousin or whatever, come by, he said, "Hey, sit down." And the guy sat down. And then he says, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down there." So they sat down. So, you know, I don't know if this was just standard order of business or if Boaz was such an influential guy that he could take the 10 elders and this guy and go, "Hey, everybody, sit down. I got something to say." But so the gate was the just the place where the judges or the rulers or the elders would sit. You know, Lot in Genesis 19 sat at the gate of Sodom. Not a good place for a righteous man. Absalom, you might remember Absalom, David's son, who was trying to undermine David's authority when people were coming for judgment. He was at the gate and going, "Hey, before you go in there, tell me what your problem is." "Oh, yeah, well, this guy broke my shovel and then he killed my cow." And, you know, he's going, "Oh, man, you know what? If I was the judge, if I was king, I would find in your favor. No problem. You'd have an advocate with me." You know, and then the guy would go in and David would say, "Well, let's hear both sides of the story and maybe not render judgment." The guy walks out of there thinking, "Man, Absalom's a guy he would have found for me." And that's how Absalom turned the hearts of the people away from David and to him there in the city gate. So here this thing's going on in the city gate. the 10 elders of the city and this guy are all sitting down. So they sat down. Verse 3, then he said to the closest relative, Naomi, who has come back from the land of Moab, has to sell the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech. So I thought to inform you, saying, buy it before those who are sitting here and before the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if not, tell me that I may know, for there's no one but you to redeem it, and I am after you. So Boaz, with this public forum before the 10 elders of the city, says, hey, it's time to redeem Elimelech's land, and you're the guy. I mean, you're the Gaal, you're the kinsman redeemer, you're the closest relative. If you don't do it, I mean, it's got to get done. And if you don't do it, I'm next in line, and I need to know if I need to do it. So the guy says, at the end of verse 4, he says, oh, okay, I'll redeem it. You know, obviously, this guy's got some money, too. I'll redeem it. And then Boaz said, you know, by the way, there's a little bit more to this. On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance. And the closest relative said, well, I can't redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself, that you may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it. So, you know, by the way, not only do you have to redeem this land, but you also have to marry, you know, the Moabitess woman. I like the way he said that, too. He says, you know, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also acquire Ruth the Moabitess. By the way, she's a Moabitess. She's from Moab, you know, cut off from the everything. You know, we talked about this in chapter 1, you know, about, you know, to the 10th generation. So the guy may have been thinking that most commentators say this, that he may have been thinking, I can't do that because it'll mess up my inheritance, because then I'll have two firstborn sons and that'll get divided and stuff. But I think, personally, I think he's talking about a Moabitess. I'm not marrying no Moabitess. That's going to mess up my inheritance. I mean, that's going to ruin everything. I'm not doing that. And so whatever it is, I mean, he doesn't get real specific, but he says, redeem it for yourself. So I'm sure Boaz was thrilled. And remember, when we talked in Deuteronomy 25, husband's brother shall go into her, take her to himself as a wife, and perform the duty of a brother's husband to her. And it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. So if the guy was to be the kinsman redeemer for the land, he'd also have to be the kinsman redeemer for Ruth, for the woman. And that was the part of the deal he didn't go for. Now, interestingly enough, we see how the law of God has changed somewhat, very much as if you go to Israel today, you'll see very strict observance to a lot of the Jewish law, but other things become very, very lax. For example, you know, we were talking about leasing the land and the ownership of the land and things. One way that the Jews, even in this century, since 1948, have observed the Sabbath of the land. Remember that you're supposed to have a Sabbath every Saturday, Friday sundown to Saturday sundown. You're to do no work. Well, God said for the land is to have a Sabbath too. Every seventh year, you need to let the land lie fallow for a year. Give it a rest, basically. That's the law that God said. You work on the land for 6 years. The seventh year, you don't plow your field. You don't harvest sow and reap your fields. You leave it alone. Well, the way the Jews get around that today, because, you know, you just can't have your field not in operation for a whole year if you're a farmer, right? The way the Jews get around that today is they will lease their land for a full year to a Palestinian. And so technically, they've given the land a Sabbath. They're not working on it. And they lease it for a part of the profits and whatever else. And so the land is producing 7 years out of 7 years. But technically, they're observing the law. Yeah. And we see here that this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redemption and the exchange of land to confirm any matter. So regarding this redemption and this whole land thing, a man removed his sandal and gave it to another. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the closest relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, and he removed his sandal. So basically what the guy, more feet, more shoes. Man, this is, I thought Ruth was a good book. So the custom at this time, during the days of the judges, you know, they were kind of following the law. Basically, if he said, you know, I'm not doing it, you do it. Well, he took off his sandal and gave it to the guy. But I want you to read Deuteronomy 25, the rest of this law of the Levirate marriage, because if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, it says in Deuteronomy 25, verse 7, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I don't desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. So according to the law of God, Ruth should have gone up, took this guy's sandal off, spit in his face, and everybody was supposed to call him. Oh, yeah, him whose sandal was removed. Remember when she spit in his face, kind of thing. Well, by the time the judges, when everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes, you know, and people are kind of compromising the word of God, he just took off his sandal and gave it to him. You know, it's like, here. So, you know, that's kind of the way those things go. So Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Kilion and Mahlon. And moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace. You are witnesses today. Now that's where we're going to stop tonight. And you'll see that there's very little left of chapter 4, but there's a really strange blessing that these guys say, basically a wedding toast or whatever blessing they say over Ruth and over Ruth and Boaz's house. And if you read the blessing that they mention and the names they mention, and then you read about the people, you're like, huh? It's very strange. And the reason I want to wait till next week is, as I said to you in chapter 1, I want to look again at the book of Ruth in a prophetic sense, because just as Boaz was the kinsman redeemer to this Gentile bride, Jesus Christ is our kinsman redeemer, redeeming us, purchasing us, his Gentile bride, the bride of Christ, the church. These things, as you read these things through, because I'd like you to go back and look at the book of Ruth again before next week and read it again. And this time start thinking about God's little favorite word games and things. Who is Boaz? Obviously Jesus Christ. Who is Ruth? Obviously a picture of the church. Who's Naomi? Who's the nearer kinsman than Jesus Christ, who could have redeemed us but wasn't able to? You know, so we will look at these things and see, and we will also look at the blessing and see how that ties into Christ. And I was saving it all up. So next week will be our finale in the book of Ruth, and really, now that we know the history of it all, really see the eye-opening and the prophecy pointing forward. Let's bow our hearts in prayer.